From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. Happy Saturday. It is June 13th. Well, on today's show, Invasive Species Awareness Week kicked off earlier this week. Tim Bruno chats with the Catskill Regional Invasive Species Partnership, or CRISP, about how people can help. We learn about biltong, a South African cured meat that's hitting farmers markets in the region this summer. I chat with Alexander Hankoff, co-owner of Brave Biltong in Tyler Hill, Pennsylvania. Plus, Rosie Starr visits Jeffrey Rose, owner of Wild Yarrow Farm in Coshocton, about getting your garden summer ready and a giant sunflower installation that the farm is working on, and what you need to know about tick-borne illnesses. All of that in Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report, but first, news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump has recast parts of the nation's capital in his own image and name. Today, that changed at the Kennedy Center, which was forced to strip Trump's name from the building under court order. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Washington, D.C.
Crystal Brewer was among the crowd who came to document the event late Friday. She said removing Trump's name was a way to reclaim a piece of Washington from a president who's tried to put his stamp on the nation's capital.
Checks and balances, accountability. It's about not being able to do something just because you think you're the most powerful person and you can defy the courts.
A federal judge ruled that adding Trump's name to the center was illegal and required congressional approval. Workers draped the facade in tarps early Saturday, which prevented the crowd from documenting the historic reversal. Brewer said she thought it was also an attempt to spare the president further humiliation. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
Pakistan, which is mediating peace talks between Iran and the United States, has said it expects an agreement to be finalized in the next 24 hours. The Pakistani prime minister said he was prepared for the truce to be signed immediately afterwards. The BBC's Joe Inwood reports.
This is the strongest signal yet that an agreement has been reached. Over the last 48 hours, first the Americans, then the Iranians, and now the Pakistani mediators have said they expect something to be signed this weekend. Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif posted on social media that we are closer to a peace deal than ever before, with finalization in the next 24 hours. But what he's talking about is not actually a full peace deal, but a memorandum of understanding that would reopen the Strait of Hormuz and most likely begin unfreezing Iranian assets.
That's the BBC's Joe Inwood reporting. Anthropic says it's taken its latest AI models offline to comply with a directive from the Trump administration. NPR's Matt Bloom reports the decision was made to prevent their use by foreign nationals.
Anthropic says it received the directive from the government on Friday. According to a statement from the company, the Trump administration's letter did not provide specifics of its national security concerns, but the company said it believed it was due to fears about potential security vulnerabilities. The export controls mark the government's most significant step to date to restrict user access to some of the world's most advanced AI products. Fable 5 and Mythos 5 are super powerful models that Anthropic says can work on complex projects and prompts for hours or even days. Anthropic called the order a misunderstanding and said it hopes to restore access to the models as soon as possible. Matt Bloom, NPR News.
This is NPR.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin was in Binghamton this week to make the case for a natural gas pipeline that failed to get state permits when it was first proposed. As the New York Public News Network Celia Clark reports, environmentalists want the state to reject the project for good.
EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin came to Binghamton on Monday to urge support for the Constitution Pipeline Project. If built, the pipeline would go through the Catskills and Southern Tier to connect with other pipelines near Albany.
I believe stronger now than I ever have in the past that New York should be reversing its ban on the extraction of natural gas.
We're not going back.
A couple of hours after Zeldin spoke, over 40 protesters gathered a block away to speak out against fracking and the Constitution pipeline. One of them is biologist Sandra Steingraber, who was a leader in the anti-fracking movement.
14 years ago,
New York State banned fracking on the grounds that fracking imperiled water and human health, and that no technology, no rules, no regulations could mitigate the dangers of this form of gas extraction.
Those who gathered believe Zeldin's visit to Binghamton is part of an effort by President Trump and the gas industry to override the will of New Yorkers who in large numbers supported a ban on fracking. In Binghamton, Celia Clark for the New York Public News Network.
Remember, we got more news anytime you need it at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the NPR Wine Club, which has generated over $1.75 million to support NPR programming. Learn more at nprwineclub.org. Available to adults 21 or older.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, now that the weather is definitely warming up this week, I have been spending more time in the sun by the river. And something that I think we should all be keeping in mind when we're spending time outdoors is our role in fighting invasive species. This week marks Invasive Species Awareness Week, an annual statewide effort to educate residents about non-native plants, insects, aquatic organisms that can really threaten our ecosystems, our economies, and in some cases, our human health. In the Catskills, invasive species can impact forests, waterways, and even local economies. Radio Catskills' Tim Bruno spoke with John Thompson. He's the director of the Catskill Regional Invasive Species Partnership, or CRISP, about the effort and how people can help.
This is New York's 13th annual Invasive Species Awareness Week. Why dedicate an entire week to invasive species, and why does this issue deserve this attention right now?
Well, invasive species are one of the greatest threats to New York State's biodiversity. It also threatens aspects of our economy and, in some cases, human health or human well-being. So it's very important that we address invasive species as well as we can, and it's up to all of the public to be involved in helping to stop the spread of invasive species.
What are invasive species, though, and why are they such a concern in a region like the Catskills and the Hudson Valley?
Yeah, so New York State, in the DEC environmental regulations, identify invasive species as having two features or two aspects. And one is that it's new to an ecosystem. And the second is that it causes some type of harm. And as I said, that harm might be to the ecosystem, it might be to the economy, or it might be to human health. So in order to address invasive species, New York State uses funding from the State Environmental Protection Fund and funds partnerships for regional invasive species management, of which CRISP is one. There are seven others in New York State. So wherever you are in New York State, there's people that are working to help to stop the spread of invasive species, help to raise awareness about invasive species. And New York Invasive Species Awareness Week is a great way to do that, to get people to focus on it.
What invasive species are currently causing the greatest concern for you in the Catskills region?
Yeah, so the ones that are high priority for us, a lot of times we're trying to anticipate what species might be moving into our area, and then looking at those species that have just moved into our area, there's opportunities a lot of times to be able to eradicate a species before it becomes widespread. And then there's species that just move really fast and have overspread our region. People might be familiar with beech leaf disease. That's a disease caused by a nematode It causes banding of beech leaves and causes them eventually to curl up and turn black and fall off the trees. So that's a major concern in an area of the CRSP region. It's 74% forested. That's one of our, the greatest, most important resources that we have in the Catskills is our forest. And to risk losing one of the most abundant trees could be a really major impact for our forests.
And you mentioned the beech issue. Are there other invasive plants that are having an impact in forests and natural areas?
Yes, there are. And there are ones that are just getting established. And that's what we're mostly working on to try to eradicate ones before they spread too far. An example of that would be mile-a-minute. That's a vine. It can grow 6 inches a day. It has little barbs on it, and it reproduces throughout the season. So it produces a lot of seeds throughout the season. And we have a number of sites where we're working on that and trying to identify any new sites for that species. We work on a lot of terrestrial species and also a lot of aquatic species. So we have summer crews out that are managing upland species. And then we have a crew that's also going out and managing aquatic invasive species like water chestnut that people might be familiar with, frog bit, and several others in some of our streams and ponds throughout the Catskills and CRSP region.
You know, people had a lot of attention. We're paying a lot of attention to the spotted lanternfly. Got a lot of good PR there, I suppose. But there are so many others that you're mentioning, and folks can find out more at CatskillInvasive.com, which is the website for CRSP. Are you organizing any events or activities during this Invasive Species Awareness Week that will help highlight some of these other invasives that are happening?
Yes, and people can find out more about those events on our website, which you just mentioned, catskillinvasives.com/events. We have two events that are coming up on Saturday. One of them is a volunteer work day at the Ashokan Rail Trail, at the Ashokan Station Trailhead. We've been in an area that was where the ash trees were killed by emerald ash borer. And invasive plants have moved in. We're removing those invasive plants, and we're planting native trees to try to restore the forest that is there. We're working with the New York City Department of Environmental Protection on that, and it's open to any of the public, anybody that would like to come and lend a hand. And then we also have an event that's in Cooperstown. We'll be pulling an aquatic invasive species called frog bit. As I said, more details are on our website, you could find out more about what we're doing on our website, and you can register on our website also.
John, before we go,
most important thing.
Before we go, I just what is it that someone could do if they're out hiking, boating, you know, gardening, camping out there, they spot a suspicious plant, an insect, or aquatic species? What should they do?
They could take a picture of it and email it to me. My contact information is on the website, or you can send it to invasives@catskillcenter.org, and that will come to me. If there's any species that you're not sure what it is, or a plant or a bug, you can send it to me if you think it's an invasive species. You could also sign up for IMAP Invasives. There's a website called nyimapinvasives.org where people can report invasive species. It's an app you can download to your phone where you take a picture and you upload it, and then someone will verify that it's a species that you thought it was, and I'll get an alert that you saw an invasive species at a certain place. So those are two simple things that people can do. We also do a lot of events throughout the year, and people are welcome to come to any of our public events, and we'd be more than happy to teach them about invasive species.
That's John Thompson. He is the director of the Catskill Regional Invasive Species Partnership, or CRISP, at the Catskill Center in Arkville. He's the leading local expert in conservation, specializing in the management, early detection, and monitoring of invasive species across the Catskills in New York State. And now you have a direct line to him if you find something suspicious. John, thank you so much for informing us and for all you're doing there.
Thank you, Tim. I really appreciate the time.
You can catch that full conversation with Tim Bruno and John Thompson over at our website at wjffradio.org. We're going to take a short break, but coming up, the latest Star Talk. Stay with us.
Two of network's biggest news shows made news this week. The president stormed out of an interview with NBC's Meet the Press.
Let's call it quits because I've had enough.
And fired 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley had words for CBS's new management.
There was a thumb on the scale for the president's version of events.
We go behind the headlines on this week's On the Media from WNYC. This afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, up next, you know what time it is? This week's Star Talk report from Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. Mercury will reach its highest point in the evening sky this week. At its peak, Mercury will be 17 degrees above the horizon at sunset. This will occur Monday evening in the western sky. As the closest planet to the sun, Mercury never strays very far from the sun and is always found low on the horizon around sunrise or sunset. All this week, Mercury will be about 15 degrees above the horizon at sunset. The sun's glare may obscure Mercury for the first 30 minutes after sunset. This presents a 30 to 35 minute window to view Mercury before it dips too low on the horizon. The sky should be dark enough to see Mercury starting around 9 p.m., and by 9:40 p.m., Mercury may be too low on the horizon to be seen. There will be a trio of bodies in the sky on Monday to lead you to Mercury. The Moon, Jupiter, and Venus will be in the same region of the sky as Mercury. The three planets and the moon will form a diagonal line starting nearly due west and angling down toward the northwest. Venus will mark the high point and the moon will mark the low point with Jupiter and Mercury in the middle. From highest to lowest in the sky, the order will be Venus, Jupiter, Mercury, and the moon. Use Venus, Jupiter, and the moon as your guide to look for Mercury low in the west on Monday evening. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks so much to Keith for that report. So if you have been to the Calicoon Farmers Market lately, you might have seen a new vendor, Brave Biltong. I'll admit that when I came across this vendor, I initially thought that it was beef jerky, but as I learned, it's actually biltong. It's a South African air-dried cured meat. Iwan Zwartz and Alexander Hankoff founded the business after years of making it for camping trips and long rides, and now they're bringing it to the Catskills. I visited Hankoff at their operation in Tyler Hill, Pennsylvania, to learn more about their story and process behind the business.
We make South African-style beef biltong, and it's all locally sourced grass-fed beef from Alpine and Honesdale. We use all organic ingredients. We use Baja Gold salt and Bragg apple cider vinegar. And what's nice about Brave is we're 4 or 5 ingredients, and that's it. So it's nice and simple.
I have lots of questions about what biltong is. I think for some people, maybe they haven't heard about this before. Tell me a little bit about what biltong is, and just kind of the history of it.
Biltong is a traditional way of preserving beef. It started in South Africa with hunters. It's the climate in South Africa is very dry, very arid, very sunny, obviously. And so what they would do with different game and beef and this sort of thing is you cut it up into sort of steaks and then let it hang dry for a week or so. What that allows it to do is, unlike jerky, which is dehydrated, usually uses some preservatives, usually has sugar and this sort of thing. Essentially what biltong is it's just air cured steak.
That sounds delicious.
It's amazing. it's a lot more like a prosciutto than it would be a jerky. So jerky, because of the dehydration side, is very fibrous and very tough to kind of eat, whereas biltong, the way that we prepare it and cut it against the grain allows it to be very tender. So it's great for charcuterie. It's great for just kind of like in between snacking, all types of applications. We started it for camping and motorcycle trips.
I'd love to hear a little bit about the beginnings of the operation. You talked about starting it when you were taking some motorcycle or camping trips. Did you ever imagine that it would bloom into what it is now?
I don't think we expected when Yvonne and I first started thinking about this as filmmakers that we would kick off a side biltong company, but in the age of AI... robots can't make biltong, so not yet, at least.
Not yet. Definitely not as tasty.
Yeah, one should hope. So yeah, the way that Brave came about was Yvonne and I have known each other for 15 years or more, and we've done lots of backpacking trips together, lots of cross-country motorcycle trips and things. And Yvonne, being South African, he's been making biltong for his entire life. His father taught him how to do it. And so he would always kind of provide this biltong on the trips that we would take. And it was always known, like, Yvonne's the biltong guy, like, we hope he brings a batch with us on this trip. Not too long ago, it was probably around 2019, maybe 2020. Actually, no, that's not right. It was more recent than that. Not too long ago, around 2022, Yvonne and I took a motorcycle trip on our adventure bikes from southern Utah all the way up into Yellowstone National Park. And as always, Yvonne packed some biltong. And at all of these different stops along the way, we would be at campsites or hanging out, you know, at like overlooks and things like that. We'd take out the biltong, cut off a little bit of a slab, and folks would always stop us and ask us what we were eating. So, you know, we would share it with different people. As the response sort of was always like, what the heck is that? And wow, that's really good. It sort of dawned on us as we were riding our bikes, and we have our comms and our helmets so we can talk on these long, boring stretches of road from, you know, national park to national park. We started talking about what it would take to maybe start an operation like this. And it was something that Yvonne had been thinking about for a while. And it was something that I just thought would be a lot of fun because I loved the product. And so it was sort of on that trip that we were inspired to make it happen. And here we are.
That's incredible. You know, since you started selling the product at the Calicoon Farmers Market, that's actually how we met. What has the response been? Is it people getting excited? Or do they have questions? Are they curious? What has that response looked like?
What's so nice about being at the Calicoon Farmers Market is that something like Brave is just like absolutely a perfect fit for folks' lifestyle up here. We're really trying to cater to people who are outdoor oriented, hunters, fishermen, hikers, you know, the list goes on and on in the Catskills of all of the different outdoor activities that this product is great for because it's shelf stable, it's clean, it's healthy. You can put it in your backpack and, you know, have it at a beautiful overlook or whatever. So it's been fun about being in the farmer's market is that I think like the customer base is already kind of hip to clean food, high protein, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They've never seen biltong before. I'm actually surprised there's quite a few South Africans that come through the farmer's market and are like, oh my God, I can't believe there's a biltong guy here. Like, that's so random. But for the general public, usually everyone says, oh, that's jerky. And I counter that with, this is what jerky wishes it was. Mm. But so basically the education when it comes to the farmer's market stand comes down to the way that we prepare it, right? So it's air cured, it's grass fed beef, there's no preservatives, all that stuff. And I think that people really gravitate towards that. And then having some free samples is obviously really helpful, because folks who may be a little bit weary because they don't like beef jerky because of how tough it is, when I encourage them to try a little bit, that's when everything changes. They take a bite. Our spice blend is really nice. We have two versions at the moment. We've got our purist and our bold, and the bold is a chipotle ancho. So some people that like spicy go for the bold, and just that response is always like, as soon as someone tries it, that's it. You know, they love it. So it's been nice being at the Calicoon Farmers Market, because I'm able to explain what it is, number one, but then also get that instant feedback from our customers. And because we're so new, that's really allowed us to sort of change things in the recipe. And, you know, we've kind of done this sort of soft launch, and the Calicoon Farmers Market feedback has been a huge advantage in perfecting our recipe over the past few months.
It was now time to check out the process. Hankoff then shows me how they turn locally sourced grass-fed beef into biltong, a South African tradition that dates back 400 years. In a corner is a custom-built drying box with slabs of spiced biltong,
which I built by hand, and we've got a whole fresh batch of Brave that's currently hang-drying. We've got temperature control and humidity control there. As you can see, we slice it into strips here, and then this is what makes up all of the sliced pouches that you end up seeing eventually. We also sell them in these slabs, but this is how it always starts. We slice up beef eye round, which is a really nice lean cut with a good fat cap, and then we bathe it in Bragg's apple cider vinegar for 24 hours so that the vinegar permeates and creates an antibacterial, antimicrobial layer. And then we spice it and we hang it. And so this will be ready by this weekend's farmers market.
And how long have these been hanging for?
These have been hanging for 3 days now. Okay. So we keep records of each batch, you know, as per the PA health guidelines and all that, which I like because I'm kind of like a data nerd. So that's all good. And yeah, by Saturday, it'll be time to slice it and bag it so that it's nice and fresh for Sunday.
That's incredible. So this is essentially ready to go just the day before the farmer's market. I mean, that is the definition of farm fresh. Yeah, it's incredible.
Absolutely. I mean, like, one of the benefits of going to that Calicoon Farmers Market is you're going to get really, really fresh product from us. Yeah. We also, we do made to order online. So everything you order online is made within a week and shipped out as well. So, you know, none of this stuff is sitting on the shelves, although it can, because it's shelf stable for up to 3 months plus. But yeah, because we're turning over pretty quickly, you're always guaranteed something that's pretty fresh.
I'm curious that, you know, there's always a testing R&D process, I imagine. How did you guys figure out, like, the perfect blend, the perfect temperatures, the right amount of days? 'Cause obviously, I imagine that maybe there weren't some batches that were farm market ready.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, so because Yvonne and I have just been making this for ourselves for so long, the R&D phase sort of happened years ago. But in order for us to get to our current spice blend and ratios and all of that, we did like an exhaustive, very meticulous blend of lots of different spice ratios and different spice ingredients and this sort of thing, and had sort of like a biltong tasting party over at Yvonne's place, and came up with the final blend, which is what we use now. And it was all, you know, sort of blind taste test. We had done a few different batches with different ingredients and things, and we landed on what we have today.
That sounds like a perfect way to spend an evening.
It was pretty good. I don't think you can ever eat enough biltong, honestly.
As you look ahead, you know, the summer I think is officially here as of today. What are you looking forward to most?
Well, we're looking forward to ramping up our production. So feedback has been incredible. Our online sales are really doing pretty well. So I was actually just out in Las Vegas looking at a fancy new pouch machine, which would eliminate our manual pouch situation, which is very time consuming and very like taxing from a manual labor perspective. So leaning into automation a little bit, be really nice to not have to like hand drop 2 ounces of biltong for hours on end into our pouches. So we're excited about ramping up our production. We're also looking at building a legitimate facility here on the property so that we can really scale up, because currently we're doing small batch, but our demand has been increasing. And so now we're looking at, you know, expanding into a facility that will be on the property, still under that LFE Pennsylvania guideline. And yeah, just excited to see different events and see what happens with the brand as the summer progresses.
And before we sign off, do you want to just let folks know how they can find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a website called bravebiltong.co. And that's BILTONG.co. The .com was very expensive, so maybe that's something we'll grow up to. And then we also have an Instagram account at Brave Biltong. And you can always come find us at the Berryville Farmers Markets. We're going to be there every other Saturday and Calicoon every Sunday.
Thanks to Alexander for such a fun conversation. Well, as we mentioned at the top of the hour, we're welcoming warmer, humid weather here in the region, and that means peak tick season. Tick season is really in full swing lately. And, you know, across the United States, Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses are rising sharply across the country. Health experts say warmer temperatures and expanding tick habitats may be contributing to the increase. Radio Catskill's Tim Bruno spoke with Dr. Kavita Agarwal of Optum Medical Care about what people can do to stay safe this summer.
It's really quite incredible if you look at the data. So what's interesting is that cases of tick-borne illness and Lyme specifically has exploded over the last 4 years. If you look at the data that's on the CDC website, you'll see that in 2021, there are about 20,000 cases over the expanse of America. And then in 2023, almost 90,000 cases. So it's really quite astounding. And we think what's happening is that, you know, due to climate change, we have warmer weather. The ticks are not dying. They are living year-round. And they're actually expanding where they're living. So it's not just a disease or an issue of the Northeast, but it's expanding westward, including the Midwest and beyond. So that's what we think is going on. And it's good that we're having this talk today so we can educate our listeners on what to do to prevent, right?
Yeah, and we want to talk about some of those prevention measures, but also want to ask about some of these other illnesses we're hearing about beyond Lyme disease, some of which I can't pronounce. What are some of these?
Let's go through them. Yeah.
Why are those becoming more common?
So, you know, the first thing to understand is that there are many different kinds of ticks, okay? And the two ticks that typically give us Lyme disease are the black-legged tick and the western black-legged tick. But in addition to multiple ticks, there are multiple infections that these ticks can transmit. So obviously we know about Lyme disease, but there's also ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis. Now, the three of these present typically very similar symptoms, fevers, chills, malaise, headache, nausea, arthralgias, myalgias, which is aches and pains of the muscles and joints. The difference between ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis compared to Lyme is that the blood work would be a little different, so that's where blood testing can help to differentiate, but treatment is similar. There's also babesiosis, which is actually a parasite that behaves very similar to malaria, and those symptoms can include profound anemia, malaise, and that one is a little bit more serious, can sometimes lead to hospitalization, and requires treatment with multiple different antibiotics. But again, you know, if you have a tick-borne illness, whatever, you see your doctor, you get checked out. A couple years ago, there was also Powassan virus, which we're not seeing as much anymore. More in the West Coast, there's Rocky Mountain spotted fever. There's tularemia. And what the Department of Health is now notifying us about, which is new, is alpha-gal syndrome. Is that the one that you were thinking about?
Yeah.
In your research?
What is that?
Yeah. So what's interesting is that there is a protein called alpha-gal that is present in meat. And people who are allergic to this can develop allergic symptoms when they eat meat. Now, when a tick has the same alpha-gal protein in them, and we're thinking they have it in them because they have bitten a host who has it, and then they have it, and then they can pass it on to the next person that they, you know, take a blood meal with and bite, and then pass it on from person to person. So if a person is exposed to this protein introduced by a tick bite and they are sensitive to it, then they can get allergic reaction response as well. So it presents not like Lyme would, but more like an allergic reaction, hives, swelling, shortness of breath, like an anaphylactic episode, which can be quite serious. So, you know, if anything like that happens, talk to your doctor, go to the ED.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions people still have about ticks and Lyme disease?
I feel like our, you know, average person is really quite well versed, especially here in the Northeast, about being wary about it in the summer months. I guess a misconception could be that thinking that it is only an infection of the summer. Now we're trying to educate our patients that it's present all year round. We've had mild winters, although this past winter wasn't that mild. But, you know, lately we've had mild winters. And if you're out and about and you're in areas where there could be a tick and they're living, you could still, you know, get a bite and get tick-borne illness. So I guess that'd be one misconception that we're trying to educate our patients on.
Let's talk about more education. Some common symptoms people should watch for after a tick bite. Many people know about the classic bullseye rash associated with Lyme disease, but does everybody get that symptom?
No. So, you know, just to backtrack a little bit, only 1/3 of tick bites are actually even noted. So 2/3 of tick bites go unnoticed. They're so tiny, they don't really hurt. It's only if you happen to see it on your body that you're going to notice they have a tick bite. And then as far as symptoms usually for Lyme especially typically begin about 2 weeks after the bite. And the first presentation can be, and it doesn't have to be, can be that target lesion, the bullseye. And that's not present all the time, only in a fraction of the cases. Honestly, it's kind of nice if that does happen because then you can see it and then act on it and get treatment. But like I said, most of the time, you're not aware of the tick bite. You don't get a rash. And then it can develop into the next stages of Lyme. And that's when you want to watch out for those other symptoms I mentioned. So for Lyme specifically, very nonspecific, very flu-like symptoms, fevers, chills, headache, malaise, tired, achy, that kind of thing, which in the winter you might think is a viral illness. But in the summer, if you're having that, the first thing to think about is Lyme. See your doctor. Get checked out.
If you do notice the tick, how quickly should you remove it? And what's the safest way to do it?
A very good question, Tim. So you want to remove it as soon as you see it, okay? What you want to use is a clean tweezer, a sharp tweezer ideally, but if it's a blunt tweezer, that's fine. You want to make your skin taut. You want to place the tweezer as close to your skin and as close to the probe from the tick that's in your body and your skin and extract the tick from there as opposed to from the body, because if you put pressure on the body, the poker, the stinger may still remain in the skin. You want to sort of take it out as an angle. Don't try to pull and tug too much. And if you can't get all of the remnants out, it's okay. Eventually it'll come out, you know, the rest of it if the stinger is left in. You want to then clean the skin with like a rubbing alcohol swab. And then since you saw that one tick, don't assume that's it. Do a full skin body check and make sure there's no other ticks on you.
Children and older adults appear to be among the groups most affected by tick-related ER visits, that spike we were talking about earlier. Why are those populations especially vulnerable?
I think, you know, because they may not have the capacity to act on it. Children certainly are nonverbal, right? And they may not know what's going on. So you really do need to depend on your parent to watch for symptoms. And if you have children, they're at camp, they're in the playground, especially the summer months, and maybe even year-round, where they're out and, you know, doing risky things in the park or in the, you know, gardens and fields and whatnot, make it a habit to do a tick check when they come inside, and then you do a full-body check. That way you can make sure that doesn't happen. And I think in the elderly, right, they're just not as aware. Maybe they're focused on their other health issues. Maybe they're not as cognizant. And those are populations are more vulnerable in general.
And for folks who are outdoors, you know, gardening, camping, hiking, what are some of the most effective prevention steps? And how effective are insect repellents like DEET or treated clothing?
Yes, so let's talk about that because, again, you know, the prevalence is increasing. So our first thing that we can do, number one thing that we should do is prevention. you can actually spray your clothing and gear before you go out on a hike. And what we recommend typically is 0.5% permethrin. As far as bug spray with DEET, that is something that you would apply on the exposed body parts, right? It's definitely effective. The data shows that it protects, but you want to be cautious in children under the age of 3. If you have a child of that age, speak to your pediatrician just to see, you know, what they would recommend that would be safe. But honestly, you also, you know, can wear long sleeve clothing, full sleeve shirt, long pants, tuck them in your socks. That way the tick doesn't have any opportunity to get onto your skin. And then just going back to, like, what else can you spray in your body? In addition to the bug spray with DEET, there's also picaridin, IR3535, eucalyptus oil, PMD, and another medication, very hard to pronounce, 2-undecanone. But again, with caution, children under 3, talk to your pediatrician.
Lots of unpronounceable things when it comes to ticks and Lyme disease. Yeah. But what should pet owners keep in mind during tick season?
Yes, very important, because, you know, often it's the pets that bring it in.
Yeah.
So pets are outdoors, they're rolling around in your lawn, they come back. So I believe there are products that you can spray your backyard with. There's also preventative products that your pet can use. Talk to your vet about that. And often we recommend that before you allow your dog or pet, you know, back in the house, you can do a tick check on them, and outside, obviously, not inside. Use rollers and whatnot to sort of, you know, do a thorough check before allowing the pet back in. And then, you know, again, just be careful, because nothing's going to be foolproof in that setting. And then maybe just do tick checks yourself, you know, each night if you do have a pet, just to make sure nothing has wandered into your environment.
And finally, what's your top advice for folks heading outdoors this summer who want to stay safe but still enjoy the season, still enjoy the sun?
Yes, and I want to emphasize this. Please enjoy the beautiful Hudson Valley. It's gorgeous. We should enjoy it. We should not be limited. But, well, if we be safe, then we'll be fine. So we talked about, you know, spraying your clothes. We talked about using bug spray with DEET and these other products. The other thing is, when you're, you know, in a high-risk environment on a hike or a trail, walk in the center of the trail. Try to avoid the edges. That's where those brushes and tall grasses and trees will be, because those ticks are at the edge waiting for a passerby to come by to jump onto. So if you walk the center of the trail, that would be ideal. We talked about what kind of clothing to wear, right? Long sleeves, long pants, tuck them in the socks. And then when you come back home, then it is ideal to toss the clothes in the dryer on hot temperature, high heat, 10 minutes, and then take a shower. And what that allows us is to wash off any ticks that have not bitten yet but are just on you. And it also gives you an opportunity to do a full, you know, body skin check. You also want to pay attention to the areas that they like to go to. And those are the warm, moist areas, like under your arms, by your ears, belly button, the hairline, your legs, your waist, and behind your knees. If you do that, then, you know, we can do the best we can to prevent tick bite and then tick-borne infection and still enjoy beautiful Hudson Valley.
That's Dr. Kavita Agarwal at Optum Medical Care. Thank you so much for the advice.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We'll take a short break, but a visit to Wild Yarrow Farm in Keshecton is up next.
Hey everyone, Tom Candela here from Curtain Call. This week on the show, I take a closer look at a remarkable new musical inspired by one of the most pivotal moments in our nation's history. Join me as I welcome composer John Allen Watts, writer Jason Huza, and director Misty Wills for an in-depth conversation about The Crossing, a powerful new work exploring George Washington, Thomas Paine, and ordinary citizens. That's this week on Curtain Call, Monday night at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Olympic champion Alana Myers Taylor says she doesn't wear her medals into restaurants to get free food anymore, like she did when she first won bronze.
Haven't tried it because I think the stigma with the gold medal is people think you can pay for a meal.
I'm Peter Sengel. This week, comedian Robert Smigel tells us if he brings Triumph the Insult Comic Dog into restaurants to insult his way to a free meal. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Farm and Country. A giant sunflower spiral is coming to Keshecton, New York. Jeffrey Rose is the owner of Wild Yarrow Farm, which offers over 800 varieties of plants at the farm. Farming Country's Rosie Starr visited Wild Yarrow Farm in Coshocton, New York, to talk to Rose about getting your garden ready this June and a giant sunflower installation that's coming together with the help of his community.
For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr, back for the season at Wild Yarrow Farm with Jeffrey Rose. I love it that the birds are chirping in the background. We're chatting about what it's like in June when it's full season for planting, and maybe it's a little chaotic with the weather. You can't plan a thing because it's either drought or deluge. But whatever it is, Jeffrey has a lot of sustainable knowledge on how to keep your garden growing and your landscape and whatever plant you have to with your green thumb. So say hello for the 26th season, Jeffrey.
Hello, Rosie. Welcome back to Wild Yarrow Farm. Always a pleasure to see you here. Yes, it is June, and June is planting season. We're on full steam ahead now, past the last frost. So that's one weather worry you don't have to have. You can get your things in the ground now. It's not too late. People come up to me all the time and say, oh my God, it's the middle of June. It's too late. Am I too late? And it's not too late. One of the things that comes about due to the climate change is our season is longer. We have a higher zone than we used to. We're now zone 6. Our last frost date is pushed back, so we might as well leverage that and do the best we can with it. Yeah, it's time to plant everything. You can put in your tomatoes and peppers and eggplant now. Although for the eggplant, I will say that we've had good luck holding back putting out the eggplant until midway through June. We seem to get outside of the flea beetle cycle a little bit, and we've had pretty good luck here at the nursery growing eggplants by holding them back just a little bit longer. Since our season is longer, we have time for the fruits to mature, and that's worked very well for us. Another thing that I'm recommending to people this year is to try planting your peppers in pots. In large pots, you need several gallons per pepper. And we find that the peppers, you can give them a little closer attention. And as well as it starts to cool off later in the season, you can bring them in on the colder nights. Because some of the hot peppers, some of the specialty peppers, they take a longer growing season than your standard bell pepper. And that's something I've been doing for the last couple of years. I'm doing it again this year. And we're looking forward to a big pepper harvest. We've gotten to the end of the no-mow May. It's nice if you have been able to let your grasses grow and let the pollinators come in before you start cutting the grass. But now, as you can see around us here, the grass is quite long, and I've got my work cut out for me to get it cut down again. But the benefit is you can see all the wildflowers and all the buttercups are so beautiful. So that's an exciting time of year.
Let's talk tomatoes. I know that you have specialized in tomatoes.
We have over 120 varieties of heirloom tomatoes this year. I've only got one hybrid. These are all open pollinated, which means that if you were to save the seed, they would reproduce true to seed. But there's a caveat there. If you are going to try to save tomato seed, and I recommend everyone try this, you need to get a little mesh bag and put it over a closed flower bud on your tomato plant. You want to prevent insects from coming in and cross-pollinating. So if you isolate the flower with a little mesh bag, and then once the flower opens, periodically jiggle the branch, and it will self-pollinate. And then once the fruit is set, you can remove the mesh bag and then tie a little ribbon around the branch so you know that that fruit has been self-pollinated and will produce seeds that will produce plants that are the same as the parent. A lot of people save their tomato seed and then they plant them and they're surprised that they get all kinds of different tomatoes as a result. And that's because of the cross-pollination. You may end up with the next great bloody butcher tomato or not. You might end up with something really awful tasting. And you can use the same technique with peppers. Another thing that I recommend with the tomatoes is diversity. This is a watchword in the garden, and diversity is really important. And by having many different varieties, you're not opening yourself up to a disease that's going to attack one particular variety. I find that having different colors of tomatoes, yellow, orange, pink, red, black, they all get affected differently by the blight. And so I think by throwing as much variety into the garden as possible, we'll draw a wide variety of different insects to your garden, and you'll have a better crop.
Is there any particular attention to tomatoes or peppers that people should attend to in their gardens? Should they fuss around or think about if it rains really hard or it gets really cold? What should they be doing to pamper their plants?
Well, the best thing is to keep an eye on them, right? So if you start to see something, do something. If you see leaves that are rotting or something looks bad, pull those leaves off. Try to maintain the area around the plant free of debris, and that'll help somewhat. We also make a comfrey tea from comfrey leaves and water in a garbage pail out here in the nursery, and we let it get really fetid and stinky, and then we dilute that and water the tomato plants with it. And we did some experiments a few years back with watering some tomatoes with comfrey tea, some with a nettle tea, and some with no tea at all. And the ones watered with the comfrey tea withstood the blight better and were far more productive. So we're fully signed on to that technique of doing it again this year.
Well, I'd like to talk to you about something exciting that I experienced last year. Coming here at the end of the season, I was walking under towering sunflowers. I understand that you're planning to plant a maize again this year. Let's talk about that.
Yes, we did. This will be the third year. It's a sunflower spiral that you can walk through to the center. I was very fortunate to have some extraordinary volunteers come down to the nursery and help us get planting. We planted over 2,000 sunflowers in the greenhouse, and we'll start putting them out into the spiral. And then it'll take up until mid-August, probably, for them to grow up. But we encourage people to come by and see them. It's beautiful and very meditative to walk in the spiral and enjoy the sunflowers. They're all different colors. And the insectiary that draws in is fantastic as well.
Mm-hmm. Did you design the spiral?
Well, the spiral is in archetypal form, right? But yes, I drew the spiral out with a series of ropes and hoses, and we spent a lot of time to try to make it as well-defined as possible. And now that it's been established and we mulch it over in the late summer, early fall, so we're good to go now with that. Also, another thing that the spiral feeds are the birds. At the end of the season, we stack up, we cut down the sunflowers, and we stack them up at the back of the lot there. And it's amazing. You walk by this pile, and dozens of birds come flying out.
Yes, I remember being under them, and it was like I was under an 8-foot, almost like a shower head. It was nice to feel so dwarfed by something non-human, non-mechanical. It was very organic. Do you have different types of species of sunflowers, different varieties?
Yes, the primary variety we used is called Autumn Beauty, and that's a branching sunflower that comes in colors from yellow to almost a deep purple. We had one come in like a deep red, and then interspersed are some others. I also planted some Evening Sun and some Russian Mammoth, which are the really tall ones with just the single giant flower head. And then at the end of last season, we went through the spiral. My neighbor Amy helped me out here. She went through the spiral and harvested some of the heads and then cleaned the seeds. And those are the seeds we're planting for this year to help try to keep the sunflower spiral more sustainable.
Oh, it's like a true circle in life. That's beautiful. You're very fortunate to be able to have that experience, be successful. That sounds very mindfully intended.
It was. It's a very intentional experience, the whole thing. And again, the amazing volunteers, I'll be calling them back to help me plant the thing. We were fortunate to have a local artist work with us last year and film the whole process. it's an exciting project, and it's nice to be able to get some of the community involved in it as well.
Yeah, how did you acquire that ability to attract the volunteers? Talk about that process.
Well, I've been very lucky. I don't know how it started, but somebody had come to me and asked if they could volunteer at the nursery in exchange for plants. It's actually how I started. About 15 years ago, I contacted a local nursery, Trina Pilonero, who became my mentor, and I asked her if I could come and work in her nursery to get some greenhouse experience. And then I ended up in subsequent years working with her. And I've had the same experience here, where people have come and they enjoy the being with the plants and spending time with us here. And I've just been really lucky. Plant growers, gardeners, they're nice people. They just are. It's a very nice community, and I'm very grateful for all the help that they bring me.
Do you get help from the birds eating either the seeds or the seedlings? Do they come in and try and nip off the heads, or any critters try and share in the joy?
Yes, unfortunately, but we have a cat who lives in the greenhouse, Hans, who many of my gardeners know Hans very well, and he keeps the critter population somewhat under control. Birds fly in and out, but they don't really do any damage.
Before we close, what else would you like to add to this high season of 2026? Any particular challenges you want to talk about, or, I don't know, joys of looking forward into the 2026 season?
Well, as you mentioned at the open there, the weather is a challenge, and there's a lot of talk about this is going to be a hot and dry summer. So we have to adapt to it. Use rain barrels if you can. Keep barrels of water out in the garden so that you can do something. If you see something, do it. Do something about it. If you see a plant has dried out or is wilting, give it a little water right then. When you put things off, the garden can suffer. But just get out there and be in it. It's a troubling world, and being in your garden can be one of the most restorative things that you do in your day.
I agree. Just having your hands in the soil and willing to admit that nothing is perfect, magazine-like, and accepting the failures and just focusing on the successes.
That is absolutely true, Rosie. I tell people often, if you're getting a 75% success rate in your garden, you are winning. It's great. Don't expect 100%, and don't expect your garden to be like decorating. It takes time. You have to be patient, and enjoy watching the season unfold.
Yes, I agree with you. Natural beauty. And I like that number, 75%. It reminds me of platinum, like us, our ages. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Rosie. Always a pleasure.
Wild Yarrow Farm has an Instagram page and is located on New Turnpike Road in Coshecton, New York. WildYarrowFarm.net has the nursery hours, location, and a fabulous menu of germinated herbs, vegetables, and perennials.
Thanks so much to Rosie for that report. Well, a few things happening in our community the next few days before we sign off. Today is Livingston Manor's annual trout parade. This is such a fun one. This year's theme is Circa de Trout. It's actually happening right now. It actually already kicked off at 10 a.m. and the parade kicks off at 1 p.m. If you do go, please keep an eye out for maybe some familiar Radio Catskill faces at the parade. If you do see one of us, come and say hi. And then on Thursday, Farm Arts Collective will host a flower cut and design workshop at their farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Participants will tour the flower field and then design a bouquet to take home. That'll be at 9 a.m. on June 18th. And that's all for this week's show. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it's Cats Cast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. I'll catch you next week.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Some people are placing winning bets on prediction markets because they're using insider knowledge. Two cases include a Google engineer and a member of the Special Forces. It can have an impact on the country as a whole.
We're leaking information to the world by not combating this type of insider trading, and that could have a whole host of consequences for how we conduct foreign policy.
That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.